Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. Don and Alexis both joining you today from the two-seated host chair. Alexis, how are we doing this morning?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Today we're actually doing something a little bit unusual for us in that we're both recording and releasing on the same day. Those of you that just completed the last four episodes might have noticed that they all had a theme. We recorded those actually in a recording block about a month ago, so we had a nice little break from recording episodes, and now suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, we owe an episode.
Yes.
So we're taking advantage of the fact that we are gathered together for the U.S. Independence holiday to record this episode and a couple of others that you'll hear over the next few weeks. So today is July 3rd.
Yes.
Which is the day we're releasing the episode and also the day that we're recording it on. But so tomorrow is U.S. Independence Day, unless it's not. Right, Lex?
I mean, it's what the calendar says, but it's not really. So, I'm going to tell a story. So yesterday, I was at work, and I was walking down the stairs. We were going to lunch, and I was walking down the stairs with my coworker and my boss. And I said, by the way, happy real Independence Day. And that's all I said. I didn't say anything else. And my coworker said, no. You can't just say something like that and not explain it. So I had to then explain what I meant, why July 2nd is really Independence Day.
All right. So either we're wishing you here from A Fork in Time if you're in the United States and you're American. We know we have global listeners, so we're not excluding our other listeners around the globe. But we're either wishing you a belated real Independence Day one day late, or we're wishing you Happy Independence Day one day
early.
But regardless of whether we're late, early, or happily in a Goldilocks zone right in the middle, we're going today, actually, as you might guess, to focus on a topic that at least touches American history because it seems topical given what's there. So one of the interesting things about American revolutionary history is the fact that there were actually a number of attempts to avoid all-out war. So today, Alexis, do you want to tell our listeners what we're going to be focusing on as the historical what if?
Yes, today we are going to be talking about the Olive Branch Petition, which is one of those attempts to avoid all-out war that was actually sent to Great Britain in 1775.
Okay, so today we're going to focus on the historical what if of what if there had been acceptance of the Olive Branch Petition and how that might have played out in terms of what we know of as the American Revolution, or maybe not an American Revolution.
Right.
And then, obviously, we can flow from that in the alternate timeline. What are some of the implications if there's not an American Revolution, which begins in 1775.
Right.
Ahead of that Declaration of Independence in 1776.
Six.
And so that's what we'll be talking about. Before we get into that, we're going to take just a quick little brief break here to bring you a word from someone who helps make the podcast possible. And we'll be right back after that to do a little bit of the historical introduction. And then we'll get off into the thing that we're supposed to be about here as an alternate history podcast, which is what would have happened if the Olive Branch Petition had been accepted. We'll be back in a minute. Taking a quick break here from the podcast, this is Don along with
Alexis.
And today we just want to talk very briefly about an opportunity that is both for you and for us. And that's an opportunity if you've been thinking about starting a podcast, like we were thinking about starting a podcast actually for a couple of years before we did it.
Yeah, this was a long road.
Yeah, and we've really enjoyed for the last half year as we've done it. When we got to the point of starting the podcast, I'd been a long-time podcast listener, as had Alexis. Alexis, what did you know about actually hosting a podcast?
Not much.
I knew at least that much, or maybe a little bit less, and so I began to do some research. And again, I'd been a podcast listener for a number of years, but as I started doing research, more and more I found myself gravitating towards where we host Fork in Time, and that's Buzzsprout. What would you say our experience with Buzzsprout has been so far, Alex?
Very user-friendly.
Incredibly user-friendly, incredibly intuitive. In fact, as I was going through setting up the podcast, which I did in a matter of probably about an hour total when I first set it up, it helped me, for example, get things set up so that I could upload audio, gave me suggestions for about how to record audio and how to edit audio, but it also went ahead and gave suggestions on how to get into all of the popular podcast search directories. So I didn't know how to get the podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, but guess who does?
Buzzsprout does.
Buzzsprout does. And I think that's among many other reasons why over 100,000 podcasts actually call Buzzsprout home. So what is the deal that we have that allow us to benefit, but also allow someone who may be listening to our shows think about starting a podcast? What benefit do they get, Lex, if they go to Buzzsprout?
So if you go to our show notes, there's a link to Buzzsprout in those show notes. If you click on that, and if you decide you want to start in this podcast venture, we don't call you competition, just welcome to the podcasting family. But if you decide you want to start a podcast and you click on that link in our show notes, you actually get a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan with Buzzsprout. And because you clicked on that link, Buzzsprout knows that we sent you there, so we actually get a little bit of a benefit as well. That's what we in the business call a what?
I think it's called a win-win.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it's a win-win. And so again, among the things that Buzzsprout provides is not just a place to host a podcast, not just a place to do the uploading, but a web page for your podcast. Players that you can embed inside of a website or that can be standalone. Basically, it's a turnkey solution to someone who's looking to start a podcast. That's how I found it to be. We can speak personally because we use Buzzsprout, and we would recommend if you've been thinking about going down the podcast avenue that you look at them too, and again, join the group of over 100,000 podcasts that have found Buzzsprout to be a great place to call home. So again, Alexis, how do they take advantage of the offer?
Go to the show notes, click on the Buzzsprout link, and then if you want to start your podcast, just follow that link and you'll get that $20 Amazon gift card with your paid membership to Buzzsprout. And then because we sent you there, we'll get a little thing too.
All right, great. Again, if you've been thinking about it, I would encourage you to do it. It's been something that we've enjoyed and I think you will too. Thanks.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast, the American Revolution edition. We're celebrating Independence Day here, and today we're going to be talking about the Olive Branch Petition and what would have happened if that had actually been accepted by British Parliament and King George III when it was sent over to try and avoid that little war called the American Revolution.
All right, so Alexis, you're going to give us a little of the historical what
did. Yeah, we got to talk about that.
So we can then go off into the historical what ifs. So what is the Olive Branch Petition and what actually happened with respect to the Olive Branch Petition?
Yeah, so the Olive Branch Petition, as I mentioned, there'd been a few of these kind of forays into trying to avoid war. So that's one of these is the Olive Branch Petition. So it was actually written and adopted by the Second Continental Congress in July of 1775 and sent over to British Parliament, to King George III. A couple of things they were asking for. One, they were asking for, of course, no taxes or a reduction in taxes. And the other thing they was asking for was representation in Parliament. Of course, we know that they did not have representation in Parliament. And King George III famously refused to even acknowledge or look at this document. He basically acted like it didn't even exist when it got to London.
And so, actually, it's interesting because these dates in July 5 of 1775 is actually the date the Olive Branch Petition was adopted. So, something magical about America's revolutionary spirit in the month of July.
We like early July.
We like early July for some reason. So, this was sent to King George. Now, as I was reading and doing a little bit of the background study on this, my understanding was part of the reason it was rejected was the week before it was presented, they had actually made the declaration, basically saying the proclamation of rebellion, saying that the colonies were in rebellion. So to have accepted, the idea was, I'm not even going to read this petition because we've already declared.
Yeah, we've already decided these people are traitors.
Right.
So I'm not even going to read this.
Right. So that's the way the history breaks down. There's interesting things there about a letter that may have been intercepted, which was actually from John Adams to someone else, which indicated some of the details about what the plans for war were. And so the concept was, well, they're just buying time with this petition. They still plan to fight. So a lot of different ways that historians have interpreted what, you know, the sincerity, what George's perception of the sincerity of the petition was and whether it could have been accepted. Although, as I I was also, you know, interested to be reminded, I guess I knew this, but it's amazing how much history you can forget, even when you've studied it, that there were precedents for representation inside of Parliament outside of Britain proper. This was not something that totally unheard of, the fact that you could have representatives from other parts of the empire or the British Commonwealth at the time, whatever the appropriate term is. I'll leave that to you as the Anglophile at that time. That was not unheard of.
No. They weren't really asking for anything that was, again, completely unheard of or completely unfounded at all. Not at all.
Okay, so the provisions primarily center around two things. One was representation. So this would have actually brought, again, these are citizens of Great Britain that are in the colonies. These would have brought colonists over to Britain to have membership in Parliament. There would have been members of Parliament, at least in theory, representing some or all of the American, the American colonies,
right,
at the time. And so that was one of the provisions. So one of it was just getting representation in government. Of course, we know the famous phrase, taxation without representation. That would have taken care of the representation part. And then what did they particularly want for the taxation again?
They wanted those taxes to be rolled back. So in the lead up to, and we've talked previously about the Boston Tea Party, following the Boston Tea Party, there were several different taxes that were implemented on the American colony. So they really wanted those taxes rolled back or at least reduced.
And a lot of these taxes, again, as we've talked about in other episodes, in fact, I'm thinking back to one of our earliest episodes, which was around the Independence Day holiday last year. That was about the Boston Massacre and how that might have been different, is the fact that some of these taxes were actually imposed upon the American colonies because to offset costs that had been incurred during the 7 Years' War called the French and Indian War on this side of the pond, to offset the cost that Great Britain incurred defending the colonies during that war. That was some of the justification for why that taxation existed in the American colonies that did not exist back in Great Britain proper.
Right, exactly. It was basically a defense cost. It was, we're the best army in the world, but we need to maintain our status as the best army in the world. One of the ways we can do that is taxes, so.
Right. So again, taking the departure here now that we've covered a little bit about the historical what if, which is an attempt, again, it's called the Olive Branch Petition. It's saying, grant, you know, we really don't want to break away. We don't want to be, in fact, independence has not been declared at this point.
No, we're still a year away from that.
The battles of Lexington and Concord have occurred. So there have been clashes, the Siege of Boston. There's military action that's happening. This is the Second Continental Congress. Again, that has sent the petition, but there hasn't been the formal declaration of independence. So this is saying we can stop the hostilities. If you'll agree to do this, we still want to be loyal subjects. This will make us even more loyal subjects because we will be more part of what's happening here. And so we're going to assume in our historical what if that the Olive Branch petition as presented was accepted.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we go down that path, and so what we're going to have here now are suddenly, at a minimum, we talked about one of the provisions here, which was asking for representation. So there's going to be American, it's hard to figure out what to call this thing. I'm continuing to use the term American because these were the colonies that were in the Americas. As we were talking off podcast, we tend to think, particularly if we're from the United States, we tend to think about the 13 colonies. There were other British colonies in North America and in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, there were about 26 colonies that were considered British colonies, so we only represent about half of that total.
Yeah, we've talked before about Canada as an example, Jamaica, yeah. There were other, so other Caribbean interests as well. So again, the Bermuda, I guess, was...
Yeah, Barbados.
Yeah, so again, there are others. So when we talk about, you know, the colonies being in rebellion in the Americas, that's distinct from the American colonies, the 13 colonies that existed there. And so what we're saying is that this petition, which was extended on behalf of those 13 colonies, included them. So we're assuming that at a minimum what would have been accepted, but I can imagine a scenario where if they were doing that, they would have just provided representation for all of the colonies.
I can see that, definitely. That's not a far cry at all.
Yeah, in fact, the other interesting thing that's happening today, I hear Maddie, I just heard the dog we referenced before in the background.
We need to put a picture of her on the website.
I just thought the same thing in my head. I will take care of that today. You hear her barking in the background. As we've talked before, she's named for Dolly Madison, also from American history. But one of the interesting things that I think about there is the other thing that's going on in the United States today. I don't know if it's if you're Disney Plus subscribers. We don't get a dime from Disney. But both for Alexis and myself, one of our favorite musicals is the Lin-Manuel Miranda Broadway musical Smash Hamilton, which is actually the movie of Hamilton that was shot on Broadway several years ago. It's actually premiering today on Disney Plus. So
we have like 3 hours set aside later that we're going to watch it.
Yeah. So a lot of things, American history and American Revolution, are inside of this. But the reason that occurs to mind in what the concept that we're talking about is Alexander Hamilton, closely associated with the American Revolution, was not born. He was born in one of those other...
Yep, he was born in the Caribbean.
Born in the Caribbean and then, you know, and moved to what would later become the United States, the American colonies, to New York, subsequent to that, about the time of the Revolution. And so, again, having all that running through my head, that popped in my head when we were talking about the other colonies, is there was movement among the British colonies that weren't just on the North American mainland. So, again, we're assuming in the alternate history that it's accepted, so there's representation. So I guess the first logical assumption of an alternate timeline is there's, at least at that, the time frame of the original timeline that we understand, there's no American Revolution.
Correct, yeah.
So these political entities, and we were talking off podcast about how to refer to them, eventually they're going to be known as states, but they still could probably go under the heading of colonies now. So if we drift back and forth between those terms, we know that that's what we're doing here. So I guess the presumption would be probably what would have been demanded, given that the colonies were together at the Second Continental Congress, is that the assumption probably would have been there would have sought at least one representative, one member of parliament from each of the colonies.
Right. There would have been having representation from each of those different colonies, because as you kind of alluded to with the colonies in the Caribbean and the colonies on the Eastern Seaboard, each of those colonies is very, very different. If you're living in Georgia, you don't have necessarily the same economy, the same needs as somebody living in Maine or Massachusetts. So you want to make sure you have somebody from each of those colonies to represent your colony to the British Crown.
Okay. So again, in our alternate timeline, we're going to assume that each of the original colonies that are represented that eventually become the states in the United States post the real timeline American Revolution gets representation. So there's at least 13 new members of
Parliament
that show up here shortly. And that, you know, because of that, there is some adjustment to the taxes or whatever happens with that. So in our alternate timeline, we have loyal British citizens living in the Americas that now feel like they're getting proper representation inside of Parliament, and so they've remained loyal. So the first obvious thing is there's no revolution, and there's no declaration of independence in the timeline that we know, because in the real timeline, the Declaration of Independence comes in 1776, the following July.
Right.
Only after it's obvious that things are not going to be settled in a peaceful manner. So under that scenario, we have colonies that are represented. So how long do we think that they stay? Eventually, much of what becomes the British Empire does eventually gain its independence. So I guess one of the first questions I would ask Alexis is, how long do we think we stay in this, we're not breaking away, but we're not yet independent mode? How long does that last?
Well, if you look at our neighbor to the north, Canada, as kind of a model, Canada gets its independence in the 1860s. So it goes from being a colony to being in this thing that eventually becomes the Commonwealth. So it's not a far cry to think it would probably be around the 1860s, 1870s. However, there's one big sticking point that I think gets in the way of us making it all the way to 1860s, and that would be slavery.
Slavery. So, as we know in the original timeline, slavery was an issue that was a divisive issue among the colonies, which eventually became the states. So divisive that in American history, in real American history, by 1861, we actually fight a civil war
Yeah.
Over, not just slavery, but slavery being the primary issue in the concept of states' rights. I understand that a lot of people don't view that war, even in the United States, as being exclusively about slavery, and that's a fair point of view. It wasn't exclusively about slavery.
It was a component, though.
But it was a major contributor. If there had not been slavery being one of the catalyst issues around the idea of states' rights and what caused the separation there, I think a very different outcome would have happened that probably would not have required war. Disclaimer now completed on that, because I know that that's not something that even all Americans would agree upon. But slavery was an important issue, and it was a backdrop issue, for example, during the writing of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. That's some of the language that would go there, because there were some who wanted to push further, making a case for the United States, as we now know it, being anti-slavery or declaring against slavery. But certainly during the early formation of the United States government post the American Revolution, slavery was a major point of contention during the Constitutional Convention. Eventually they come to the settlement of the three-fifths rule,
yep,
for how to deal with apportionment, how to count slaves as citizens and all of that. And it almost prevented the actual formation of the Constitution as we know it today. So it was a divisive issue.
Yes.
I give that background to say we know that it was an issue that divided the states and that they were not in agreement upon. So what was the status of slavery in the British Empire, I guess during the period of time we're talking, 1775 and moving forward?
So there's two key dates that need to be discussed in the terms of slavery when talking about the British Empire. Slavery was a big component of the British Empire. We have that whole triangular trade thing. I remember the triangle that I learned about in middle school, going from Africa to Europe over to the Americas. So in this time, slavery was a big component. Now there's two dates that occur before the 1860s that are kind of banner years. One is 1807, and that is the abolition of the slave trade throughout the empire. The other one is 1833, which is the abolition of slavery in general. So you can't even have a slave anymore. Not just trade them, but not have any slaves. So those 2 years are much before 1860s. And I think those would have been major sticking points in America, because as you mentioned, even when we're trying to write the Constitution and things like that, slavery was a big part. So I think if we're still loyal to Britain, and you have Britain saying, okay, you can't trade slaves, I think trading slaves is like, okay, that we don't like that, but we'll get on. But then it was, okay, you can't even have a slave in 1833, and I think that would have been a banner year in terms of relations between Great Britain and the colonies that have remained loyal up to this point.
Yeah, so let's say we still have the original 13 colonies, although we'll talk a little bit about how the evolution of additional colonies or states or political entities may have played out in a post-late 18th century continental situation that's still loyal to Britain. But certainly there was not commonality. Those in Massachusetts and those in South Carolina, for example, thought differently about slavery.
That's an understatement, yes. Yeah.
So now imagine that you have their representatives over in Parliament when this is happening are not going to have a united, quote-unquote, American position about this. I think it's very unlikely. In fact, I think it's virtually impossible that the member of Parliament, or maybe members of Parliament, they may have by that point been allowed to have more. We don't know how that would have played out, but at least assuming there's one member of Parliament from Massachusetts or one member of Parliament from Pennsylvania being another example of some of the ones that were most vociferously anti-slavery,
right,
during the formation of the American Constitution, I don't think that they would have united with the member of Parliament from
Georgia or South Carolina
or Virginia even to say, you know, we stand on your side. We believe that the practice of owning slaves or trading slaves even to the American colonies in either 1807 or the ownership in 1833, it's unlikely they would have been united on that issue.
Correct.
And so as a result of that, you would have had a scenario where, and they were not necessarily united on other issues as well, but you would have had a scenario where you still might have had now American colonies who are heavily dependent upon their agriculture, their agricultural mechanisms heavily dependent upon, at least at that point in time, the ownership of and slave labor, who might have been opposed to the abolition of slavery. So if you get to 1833, using that as the date, again, assuming there wasn't a need to continue the slave trade, there were already plenty of slaves here for the means that were needed, is you get to 1833 and this is declared. I guess there's one of two possible outcomes there. They would have rolled with it because they had no choice but to roll with it, or what's the other outcome?
Let's go to war.
Yeah, let's think about becoming independent or issuing a petition or doing something similar to what was done during the real American Revolution, which has not happened now, but the issue is not over taxation. The issue is not over representation. The issue is exclusively over
slavery.
Over slavery. And so, again, thinking through that scenario, let's imagine that the colonies that we know that eventually did become the states that became part of the Confederacy. So now we're talking about Virginia. We're talking about North and South Carolina. We're talking about Georgia, just using those. Maryland and Delaware in the American Civil War were border states. They sort of were neutral. So they were slave-holding states, but chose not to join the Confederacy. So right. Maybe as many as, also including Maryland and Delaware, as many as six colonies in 1833 may have been very upset about the fact that slavery was being abolished, to the point that they were willing to become or declare independence or to rebel in some way over that particular issue. They certainly were willing to rebel against the United States over that issue.
Yes.
So under that scenario, the first thing that pops to my mind is there would have been, I guess, the potential for a version of the American Civil War, and it would have still had some of the same regions of the United States organized the way they were in terms of being for and against, in this case, slavery being the divisive issue. But now the North, as we know it, would not have been the North of the United States. It would have been what? It would still have been the loyal subjects of
Britain, yeah.
Yeah. And so the war that would have broken out in this sort of new American Civil War in this alternate timeline would have been not between the northern and southern colonies,
right,
necessarily only them, but the northern colonies would have been backed by the full force of
the British Army.
The British Army in the 1830s. And that's a very different scenario than what we actually had in the true American Civil War, where actually, by the time of the American Civil War, the Confederacy had some support and tried to garner some support from
Great Britain.
Yeah, even though Great Britain was not in favor of slavery, the economics and other political considerations meant that there was actually a little bit more sympathy and connection between the Confederacy and Great Britain than there was between the North. But under this scenario, 30 years earlier, where you still have loyal subjects, the American Civil War, again, is not fought amongst the states. It's fought amongst all of the empire, including the northern states or colonies, against their southern brethren.
Right, and you know, I mentioned we have the backing of the British Army now. We also would have the backing of the British Navy, which, as we talked about during the Spanish Armada episode a couple weeks ago, the British Navy is one of the best navies in the world. So if you have the British Navy coming over to assist the northern colonies and blockading the southern colonies, does that create this whole other issue of, yes, we're fighting on land, but we're also dealing with having to get supplies in and out with the best army and the best navy in the world defending these northern colonies.
Right. And so, you know, again, we talked about the immediate obvious change is there's no revolution. But when there's no revolution there, do you eventually come to the point where there's a different type of revolution? I would suggest that there's a better than even chance that by 1833, with the passage of that, you would have the Southern Revolution, the slavery revolution, whatever we would call the rebellion, the revolt, the dissent.
Yeah.
And the most likely scenario there, if you look at just what the forces and capabilities were, again, you mentioned not just the British Army, but you mentioned the British Navy. I don't know who would have come to the aid. Others may have come to the aid. In fact, I'll carry this idea that which just popped in my head a little bit further. But I think the most likely scenario could have been that rebellion being quickly quelled.
Right.
And there wouldn't have, if there had been a war, it would have been a short-lived war. It would have been a victorious empire putting down the rebellion, at least for the near term, and enforcing the abolishment of slavery in much the same way that after the real timelines, American Civil War and Reconstruction, slavery was also abolished. So you basically just advance a lot of the post-American Civil War effects that we think of to being 30 years earlier, and instead of it being the United States, the reconstituted United States enforcing that, it's the British Empire.
Right.
Then the other thing that occurs to me, though, is a lot of events do happen between 1775 and 1833 that are important.
Mm-hmm.
One of those is 1803.
Yeah, there's this big chunk of land that gets sold.
Yeah, and it's sold by France. It's sold to the young United States. It's the Louisiana Purchase.
Uh-huh.
And as we've talked about in other episodes, it's come up multiple times, basically doubled the size of the legitimate territory
yeah.
that the United States would claim. And it was a transaction where Napoleonic France sells its holdings in the New World to the United States. What are the odds of Napoleonic France selling the Louisiana Purchase to the British?
Less than zero is my assumption on that. It's like, hey, King George, I know we're fighting, but I really need to offload this land. So can we, like, under the table, I'll give you... Like, that doesn't make any sense in my head whatsoever. So I think if we have the colonies being loyal to Great Britain still, the chances of us growing in 1803 the way we do with the Louisiana Purchase, that's not reality.
Right. And then, of course, eventually we've already had the French Revolution before now and the other things that would be happening in France, the Napoleonic Age, eventually coming to the end in 1815.
Yeah.
But that causes me to wonder, and again, I haven't thought this through in enough detail to know exactly which way I would come down, but France still needs to raise money for the wars that it's fighting. And so it probably still would have been looking to unload this territory in the Americas. A very likely candidate, if it's not the United States, a very likely candidate could have been maybe Spain.
Yep.
Could have been some other European power who did already have some interests over in the United States that were not aligned against Napoleon directly in the same way. And so now imagine the scenario where a lot of the history that we know, particularly in the 19th century, the early 1800s, which is influenced by American expansion, Manifest Destiny, the Louisiana Purchase. There's that little interruption of the second conflict with Britain in 1812, the War of 1812. But you end up in a scenario where Spain acquires a larger territory in the United States. And so many of the things that we know that eventually flow down to other topics we've talked about frequently here, which is Spanish occupation, Mexican independence, then how that plays out with what eventually becomes the Texas fight for independence.
Mm-hmm.
What if there's more Spanish influence in Louisiana and the other parts of the Louisiana Purchase? You can see a very different timeline that would develop or would have been developing moving forward with what would have happened by negating the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and that's negated because the Olive Branch Petition is...
Accepted.
So that's one of those sort of, what would have happened? Well, what would not have happened would have been the Louisiana Purchase. Now, jumping back to the 1833 Southern Slavery Rebellion, I guess I'll call it that for lack of a better term, is now imagine you're those Southern colonies looking for an ally.
Spain's right there.
And it's not only right there, but right nearby, potentially, because having acquired the territory, that's the Louisiana Purchase. And so what you may have had there is, if it didn't resolve quickly with the rebellion being put down by British forces, including the northern colonial forces in North America, the Canadians and the Massachusetts contingent and the Pennsylvania contingent and New York and all of those things, is you may have had a situation where that may have been a catalyst for erupting into something that would have been not just a conflict inside of the British Empire rebellion, but could become a catalyst for a larger confrontation between interests that might have, for example, have included Britain and...
France, yeah.
And Spain.
And Spain, yeah.
Yeah, being in the mix there. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, and that's interesting. And a thought that just popped in my head is, the Southern Slave Revolt, let's call it that for lack of a better word, they're rebelling because of slavery, but they could have gained allies that didn't necessarily agree with holding slaves. So, for instance, Spain, possibly even France. It could have been, we're going to ally with you because we don't like Britain. Not that we're necessarily agreeing with what you're fighting for and what you're fighting to preserve. We just want to annoy our enemy, which is Britain. So I think it's not a far cry to see Spain or possibly even France allying with these southern states that are rebelling simply because they're trying to harry their enemy.
Yeah. So that's the scenarios. That one is the immediately that it's put down rebellion. Skipping over the 1803 thing, which I think is an important part of this. You don't have the United States because there's no rebellion in the 1770s, but you also don't have what becomes the United States potentially because of the change there, not being an independent nation from Britain. So those are the scenarios where it's put down quickly by Britain, or it protracts out into a larger conflict. The outcome of that could have gone either way and would have had repercussions and ripple effects. But then the other possibility is maybe Britain says, yeah, whatever, we'll grant you your independence or quasi-independence, or maybe they are able to fight and sustain long enough in some ways like the American Revolution that it's just eventually settled because it's not worth the continued efforts to maintain. And so you end up with what is a form of, in the real timeline we think of as the Confederacy, the Confederate States of America. You end up with a different version of that emerges in 1835, for example. And, you know, then you start trying to think through, what does that look like? How independent does that become? It doesn't include all of the territory that eventually it came to include because there is no Louisiana Purchase.
That was really hard to get through in my head. It was so hard to divorce myself from what I know as the Confederacy in my head, because so many states in the Confederacy in the real timeline were part of the Louisiana Purchase.
Right. And or later became an important part of the consideration. We've talked so often about Texas history because we're from Texas, about how that interplays, you know, with Texas independence, what's going on in Mexico. It's easier for me to imagine a scenario where there may have been an alliance, more of an alliance between Mexico and we'll call it the Confederate States of America. They probably would have chosen something else.
Right, different name.
Yeah, to represent these ones that successfully did gain their independence or quasi-independence in this 1830-ish slave revolt, 1833, how does that play out? Well, that plays out, again, now further down history in the sense of the rest of the shaping of what we think of as the United States today, the rest of the shaping of what North America would be could be very different. You know, I can imagine a scenario where eventually, you know, perhaps, although I think they thought of themselves as being very distinct and different, the American colonies versus Canada, but perhaps you do end up, by the time you get to the 18, when does Canada gain its independence?
1867.
Yeah, so by the time you get to 1867, maybe what initially forms there is some joint Canadian-American political entity that is then part of, you know, another form of manifest destiny that's moving across now, sweeping across the northern modern United States. And so again, the map we would have today may still be this very large independent country called some combination of, maybe we're all called Canada, although I doubt that. But maybe it's some combination of, you know, the British America or something like that, where Canada's brought into that. And there's still a very large country, but it's further north.
Right.
Spain controls still much of what we think of as being the southern United States, or Mexico controls that. There's this little pocket of this thing that's the Confederate States, whatever they're called there. And you have a very different modern map in the way that that plays out.
Well, and I'm just thinking about, if those Confederate states, whatever we're going to call them, if they do get granted their independence, they're landlocked now because they can't go further west because they've got Spain that has taken all that territory. So it's this really little country on in North America in comparison to if Canada and the British American colonies combined into one country, and then you have Spain controlling in Mexico. So it's this little country, bigger than some other countries in the world. But it's an interesting map I'm drawing in my head.
Yeah. I think I can imagine a lot of different maps in the way they would have played out there. But for example, where we're sitting right now, which is in, which we've talked about before, is in the United States because of the Texas Revolution and how that plays out. I can imagine a scenario where we're sitting right now is not connected to whatever the independent, the gaining of independent, ultimately gaining of independent American colonies, let's say in the 1860s, along with Canada, probably aren't controlling this territory.
No.
And as a result, this, where we live, we might be speaking, as we're talking about, might be speaking Spanish. You know, maybe if there had been more of an influence down with, you know, the Canadian element sweeping down further south. I don't know. I really don't know. When I say I probably can hear it in my voice, I'm struggling to figure out what this looks like. I just know it's a very different looking map.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't establish the baseline of this solid block of along the Atlantic coast colonies that become states and then start moving almost almost in every case a direct westward expansion.
Yeah.
That it's buoyed by the 1803 purchase, the Louisiana Purchase, and then subsequently what happens. There's an interruption, obviously, with the American Civil War, but there's the concept just continues rolling forward throughout the entire 19th century. Can you think of any other major departures if the Olive Branch petition had been accepted?
I think we hit on the big ones. Yeah, again, it's just, it's so interesting how this one little piece of parchment that gets read or doesn't get read, and all of a sudden we're sitting in a different country modern day.
Yeah. Because one of the more interesting things, we didn't mention this, but in the real timeline, I want to mention this now, is that the concept of even could this have been accepted, we talked about why it wasn't. But what actually does happen a couple of years later is there is a, the Carlisle Peace Commission comes along. I guess that's in 1778.
Yep, yeah.
Which is actually after the war has started, after independence has been declared. Essentially, the Britain sends peace commissioners to the United States to negotiate, pretty much willing to accept everything that had been in the Olive Branch petition. So, you know, part of the thing, well, you say back, well, in 1775, they would never have accepted the Olive Branch petition. Well, 3 years later, they basically are willing to grant everything that's in there. The difference is by 1778, independence has already been declared. Part of the reason the British are willing to do that is that the war is not necessarily going well. It's a costly war to maintain. And so the Americans, now we can accurately call them that, those that have declared independence in 1776, up the ante by saying, yes, it's all of that, but it's also in its independence.
Right.
And so you say, well, you know, this whole idea that the Olive Branch petition would have been accepted. In 1775, it didn't. You understand why it didn't happen. But just 3 years later, by the time of the Carlisle Peace Commission, there's a willingness by the British government to say, yeah, we'll do that.
Right.
And so you can imagine that scenario. So maybe another topic for a different day would be what if that had actually been the outcome. I think the reality would have been very similar to the one that we've talked about today. This would have been 3 years later removed. But eventually, again, you don't have an independent United States, and all of the other things that we've talked about flow from that. The only other thing that I want to actually mention, now thinking back also to the entanglements in the war on the continent, particularly against France, the Napoleonic Wars, and obviously Britain being a major part of that, not the only player in that, but the major player in that, is now imagine that in those contingents that would have been at battles like Waterloo eventually, would have been potentially American soldiers or soldiers that would have been part of the British Army that were drawn from the colonial interests in the Americas.
Wow, yeah.
So, you know, right now, you know, as Americans, when we think of history, we think about, you know, what that was a continental war that went on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sort of did spill over in other ways to what was going on here, but you actually would have had those that were born on North American soil that were British subjects who would have been participants.
Yeah, going to fight.
Going to fight in that war over in France. So ironically, 100-esque years before Americans go to fight on European soil in the First World War, and then subsequently in the Second World War, you would have actually had Americans, or at least those born on American soil, who would have been fighting but they would have been fighting for Britain against Napoleon during the various wars that were part of, you know, that were part of the Napoleonic campaign. So that's just another thought of what's there. You know, if we were still my ancestry, my biological ancestry, I know comes down through New York. So I guess I probably still would have been an American somehow there. But, you know, I may have had ancestors who had fought and died at Waterloo, for example.
Right, or Trafalgar.
Or Trafalgar, yeah, if they were in the Navy. That type of thing, which is an interesting thing to think about. All right. Anything else pop to mind, Lex?
Nothing that comes to my mind.
All right. Well, again, once again, we appreciate you joining us here on A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. It's the end of the podcast, so we're going to go through our obligatory checklist of things that you can do. One of those things, though, is social media. And I just want to make a special pledge here. I have to tell you that if it weren't for going and posting about the podcast each week, which I normally do on Facebook, I probably would be avoiding social media. Social media is not my favorite place right now with a lot of what's going on.
Mine either.
In the world and some of the disagreements that are there, particularly inside of this nation. I'll just leave it at that without going further than that. Except to say, you can do something positive on social media, which is... do what, Lex?
Talk about the podcast.
Yeah, if you feel the need to post on Facebook or Twitter or social media and you don't want to upset a lot of people, a good thing you can do is actually post about the podcast. I'm just going to encourage you to do that today, as to actually go. And we really would appreciate it. If you do enjoy the podcast and want to get the word out, social media is a good way to do that. You can make people aware of it, and they can become aware of it and find the podcast there. It's not just Facebook, but Twitter, all the other things. Of course, you can find all of those things on our website. That's www.aforkintimepodcast.com. We've talked so much about what's there before. Access to the entire back catalog, the place to make suggestions, the place to actually, if you are willing to and are able and are so inclined to do so, support the podcast monetarily. You'll find the link to our Patreon page there. We would appreciate that. We were just talking before, as we started to record here, we're using the microphones, which we've had for the last 4 to 5 months, which we hope you can tell when we record in person, do improve what we're doing here. That was made possible to some degree by, you know, the contributions that are there, yep, to offset that cost. So we appreciate that. Again, as we always like to say, we want to just say thank you for being a listener, particularly if you're a loyal listener. If you haven't subscribed, go and hit the subscribe button. It means that you're going to get the podcast showing up in your pod feeder of choice each week automatically. You don't have to go looking for it and all the other things that you can do with that. But most importantly, we just appreciate the fact that you give us a little bit of your time and support. Anything you want to say to the listeners, Lex?
We already said it, but thank you.
Yeah, thanks again. And again, we encourage you to go and check out, they give us feedback there on the website. There's a number of different ways to do that. So as we draw to a conclusion here for this episode, again, we say thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next time on A Fork in Time. Until then, so long.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more about the podcast at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Join us next time.